is Wednesday, April 28th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Jim Lopo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, U.S. sends critical assistance to COVID-overwhelmed India.
We are sending the actual mechanical parts that are needed for the machinery they have to build a vaccine.
Also, Secretary of State Antony Blinken visits Africa virtually.
We're very much committed to working with partners to advance peace and security in Africa in the short term. Sometimes that looks like security partnerships.
Plus, Nigerian lawmakers call for a state of emergency. These stories and more are next. Amid criticism that the U.S.'s response to India's COVID-19 crisis has been slow, President Joe Biden said his administration is sending a whole range of critical assistance to the country overwhelmed with a deadly second wave of the coronavirus. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has the story.
Funeral pyres are burning across India as close to 200,000 people have died from the coronavirus. In New Delhi, a parking lot was turned into a makeshift crematorium, with residents saying they have never witnessed such scenes. Families in hospitals like this one in Bareilly are arguing with nurses and doctors as their loved ones are dying due to a lack of oxygen. President Joe Biden said he spoke at length with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi on Monday, and the U.S. is immediately sending a whole series of specific help that he needs.
We are sending the actual mechanical parts that are needed for the machinery they have to build a vaccine. We're also discussing when we'll be able to send actual vaccines to India, which will be my intention to do.
Biden said the U.S. needs to quickly make sure that other vaccines, such as Novavax, are approved for use, and then it can share actual vaccines, as well as know-how, with other countries like India that so desperately need them. Defense Department spokesman John Kirby said the Pentagon is mobilizing.
The department is working closely with other U.S. agencies to rapidly deploy oxygen-related equipment, rapid testing kits, personal protective equipment, and other essential materials to our Indian partners.
Kirby said the U.S. will also provide India's frontline healthcare workers with support. With the dramatic surge of cases in India, human rights advocates say at their meeting next week, members of the World Trade Organization need to temporarily waive intellectual property rights in a bid to widen access to COVID-19 vaccines to more countries. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
The CDC says fully vaccinated Americans no longer need to wear masks outdoors, with some exceptions. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
It's what CDC Chief Rochelle Walensky calls another step toward normalcy.
There are many situations where fully vaccinated people do not need to wear a mask, particularly if they are outdoors.
She says the exception is in a big crowd, like a stadium. The change comes amid hopeful signs: drops in virus cases, hospitalizations and deaths, increases in vaccinations, and data showing most virus transmission happens indoors.
If you're vaccinated, you can do more things more safely.
President Biden says more than a third of American adults are now fully vaccinated, and he hopes the new guidelines spur more people to get shots. Sagar Magani, Washington.
A historic trip by a U.S. Secretary of State, more so because he did not actually go anywhere. On Tuesday, Antony Blinken made his first Africa visit, virtually dropping in on six events and meeting top leaders in continental heavyweights, Kenya and Nigeria. VOA's Anita Powell followed him from Johannesburg.
Protecting global human rights through good governance is a cornerstone of American foreign policy. And U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken hit those points hard in his opening event Tuesday with alumni of the U.S. government's Young African Leadership Initiative. But the casual nature of the virtual exchange, which he called 10 Questions with Tony, did not stop these young Africans from asking the U.S. new top diplomat some tough questions about everything from climate change to Chinese influence to growing extremism on the continent. It all comes down, he said, to this.
We're very much committed to working with partners to advance peace and security in Africa. In the short term, sometimes that looks like security partnerships, conflict mitigation support and diplomatic advocacy on human rights. Ultimately, I think the most important thing that we can do is to help countries, where possible, strengthen their democratic institutions, strengthen the ability to deliver progress for people, economic growth, and that's the real foundation that we need to put in place.
The virtual nature of the visit meant that Blinken, from the comfort of his D.C. office, traversed huge distances in no time. After meeting virtually with the Yali alumni, he then zipped over to Nigeria, where he met with the president and foreign minister, and then, 90 minutes later, clear across the continent to meet with Kenya's president and foreign minister. He also spoke with officials in both countries about their efforts to battle the pandemic. He also did not shy away from discussing the virtual elephant in the virtual room, the U.S.'s largest adversary, which is making serious inroads in Africa.
Countries in Africa will and should engage with a broad array of partners, whether it's China or France, Turkey or Brazil, the United States, or many others. And my hope is that African countries and African communities just approach those relationships with your eyes wide open. China's a global competitor, and competition is a good thing, as long as it's basically fair and the playing field is level. But as we look at it, we have different approaches to governance, we have different approaches to business, we have different approaches to security, and the fundamentals sometimes of our partnerships are quite different.
With this visit, Blinken could outpace his predecessor in terms of engagement on the world's fastest-growing continent. Under previous U.S. President Donald Trump, two secretaries of state visited Africa, once each. Blinken's staff says this visit will not be his last, and that he hopes to make an actual trip once it is safe to travel again. In the meantime, he said, he will play it safe and listen to the voices from the world's youngest population. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
With this week marking 100 days of Joe Biden's U.S. presidency, European allies are noting the change in the key relationship with Washington. Henry Ridgewell reports from London on how the new administration is being viewed from across the Atlantic.
Even via video link, the transatlantic change in tone is palpable. Joe Biden's US presidency has brought radical change to the alliance, and Europe has warmly welcomed the transformation, says analyst Leslie Vingemuri of Chatham House.
He wants to work in concert with America's allies and partners, and most especially those who are in Europe. So I think that that has been absolutely critical. And the fact that Biden's been so quick off the block to bring America firmly back into the key multilateral institutions and to really draw a line in a good way under America's commitments to climate and to health.
The United States has rejoined the World Health Organization and the Paris Climate Agreement. Biden's Secretary of State has twice visited Brussels, underlining support for NATO and the European Union. Washington has also joined talks aimed at reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, which Europe sees as a triumph of its diplomacy. The former Trump administration withdrew from the accord, viewing it as seriously flawed. Biden also has taken a new approach with U.S. rivals, labeling his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin a killer and imposing two rounds of sanctions on Moscow. Pavel Sharikov is from the Russian Institute for U.S. and Canadian Studies.
The new sanctions were kind of more serious than the sanctions introduced by Donald Trump during the previous 4 years. And Russia saw that as Russia was frustrated. Russian government did not understand what was going on.
Meanwhile, Russia has sent over 100,000 troops to the Ukrainian border, widely seen as a test of President Biden. For now, analysts say Biden is still enjoying a political honeymoon with European allies. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The parties negotiating a revival of the Iran nuclear deal agreed on Tuesday to speed up efforts to bring the United States and Iran back into compliance, diplomats said. Iran, Britain, China, France, Germany, and Russia began a third round of meetings in Vienna to agree on steps that would be needed if the 2015 agreement, which former U.S. President Donald Trump abandoned in 2018, is to be revived. The main differences are over what sanctions the United States will need to remove, what steps Iran will need to take to resume its obligations to curb its nuclear program, and how to sequence this process to satisfy both sides. U.S. lawmakers grilled President Joe Biden's Afghanistan peace envoy on Tuesday about how women will be protected if the hardline Islamist Taliban take control after U.S. troops withdraw. They threaten to withhold funding if right gains are reversed. Brian Wood of Reuters reports.
The U.S. envoy to Afghanistan says Washington intends to protect human rights there, even after a planned complete military withdrawal later this year. Zalmay Khalizad testified to Congress on Tuesday.
We intend to maintain our embassy and will continue to provide development assistance, promote economic investment, and advocate to preserve the gains for minorities and for women, including their meaningful participation in the ongoing negotiations and their appropriate representation throughout society.
President Joe Biden announced earlier this month that the U.S. would withdraw its military out of Afghanistan by September 11th, 20 years after the 9/11 attacks that sent the country to war. But on Tuesday, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee expressed concern over that move, particularly for women's rights, if turmoil breaks out as a result. Republican Senator Ron Johnson is a member of the committee and argued women would be most vulnerable in a civil war if one were to break out.
What can you say publicly in terms of what the predictions are in terms of Taliban treatment of women should they take over the government? Again, personally, I'm concerned about public executions and other forms of brutality that will just be so incredibly offensive. And if that's the case, what do we do?
When the Taliban ruled Afghanistan in the late 1990s, women were barred from much of public society, like education, work, or showing parts of their bodies. Moral offenses were punished by flogging and stoning. The Biden administration has pledged to continue providing aid to Afghanistan even after its departure, but has also threatened to make an enemy out of Afghanistan if the country did not protect human rights.
That's Brian Wood of Reuters. This is the Voice of America. China has renewed its criticism of Japan's decision to release treated radioactive water from the wrecked Fukushima nuclear plant into the Pacific Ocean. Foreign Ministry spokesperson Zhao Liyan called a decision to release the water over the next 2 years a money-saving measure that is, quote, extremely irresponsible, unquote. Police and health officials say at least 7 people have been killed and more than 11 others wounded when a vehicle exploded outside a police headquarters in Somalia's capital Wednesday. The Al-Shabaab extremist group has claimed responsibility. Al-Shabaab often targets high-profile areas of Mogadishu, and observers had warned that the Al-Qaeda-linked group might take advantage of Somalia's current political tensions to strike again. The bombing comes a day after the country's president bowed to international and internal pressure and gave up efforts to extend his term by 2 years. Turkey's defense ministry says warplanes are striking suspected Kurdish militant targets in northern Iraq while commando troops are conducting a search and sweep operation. Turkey's military on Friday launched a new ground and air offensive against militants of the banned Kurdistan Workers' Party, which maintains bases in northern Iraq, and have used the territory for attacks against Turkey. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Nigerian lawmakers have called on President Muhammadu Buhari to declare a state of emergency to deal with deteriorating security countrywide. Members of the House of Representatives passed a resolution in Abuja Tuesday after heavily armed militants overran some military bases and occupied parts of Niger State close to the capital city. Militants also attacked security posts in the southeast, killing several soldiers and a policeman. For more, I spoke with security analyst Mohammed Abubakar.
We are gradually drifting into a failed state because we are seeing proliferation of non-state actors having access to arms, and they are becoming a law unto themselves. Any society where you don't have single entity exercising monopoly of violence, the rule of law, and that society is drifting into anarchy, and that society should be called a failed state. In Nigeria today, you see proliferation of non-state actors everywhere. Is it IPOB? Is it ISWAP? Is it JAS? Is it the bandits? They are all constituting a law unto themselves. So it's an unfortunate thing. The country is drifting into a failed state.
The government is blaming politicians and opponents of the ruling party as being responsible and fueling these insecurities.
Honestly, this is a flimsy excuse. If the government is blaming politicians, who are those constituting the government? Are they not the politicians? And the opposition party, are they in control of the NIA, DIA, the Army, Police, Navy? Are not in control of any of the government security apparatus. So the government that is blaming the opposition is not serious. You have all the state apparatus of law enforcement agency in your hand. You are supposed to use them to discharge your duty to protect the lives of property, the lives of property of Nigerians who voted you into power. They can't be putting blames on opposition. If it is the opposition party that is doing it, let them make mention of people, prosecute them.
How far are economic challenges and poverty fueling these security challenges?
Well, I think 70% of the cost of this thing is, it has to do with economic challenge. People are finding it difficult to survive. The meager amount of money people receive as salary cannot take them for up to a week. And how many people are even gainfully employed? So the unemployment, a cacophony of so many reasons combined together has led the poverty level in Nigeria to be very endemic. And people have to survive. This, I think, is making so many of them to volunteer themselves as willful tools into the hands of the bandits and the terrorists. The opposition are right. The government is not really making good use of strategies to mitigate this thing. Arrest and prosecute culprits. Get who are those people importing the small arms.
What are the wider implications of an unstable, insecure Nigeria?
I think deep down, nobody wants to exit the union. But because of the frustration, if care is not taken, it can make the union to collapse. It has happened in South Sudan with Sudan. It's happened in Yugoslavia and so on and so forth. It can make the union to collapse. At the moment, our security agencies are overstretched because of proliferation of cases of violence and insecurity across the various divides of the country. I don't know how countries like Niger can cope with it. It will be very disastrous for the whole West African sub-region.
That's security analyst Mohammed Abubakar speaking with me from Abuja. For a second year, Nigeria's Muslim population, the largest in West Africa, is celebrating the holy month of Ramadan under the cloud of COVID-19. Nigerian mosques have resumed communal prayers and daily fast breaking, which were banned last year, raising concerns among health officials. Timothy Obiezu reports from the capital, Abuja.
Since Ramadan started April 13, Isa Idris joins hundreds of Muslims who observe special evening prayers at Abuja's Nasfat Mosque daily. And once the prayer has ended, they all proceed for iftar, a large meal to break the day's fasting. Idris says he struggled during Ramadan last year because of the pandemic.
As of last year, even for food in my house, sincerely speaking, God bear me witness, I found it difficult. It was my mom that helped me. But unfortunately, this year, I get food in my house, and I do my iftar here, and I also do my sahur here.
Sahur and iftar are meals to mark the beginning and end of a day's fasting. Hundreds of people at the mosque benefit from free meals through Ramadan. But feasting and communal prayers were halted last year as the coronavirus restrictions held firm. Many, like Idris, who depended on such meals, struggled to get through the fasting. Muslim clergy and head of the Nasfat Mosque, Sharafuddin Abdusalam, says they found other ways to hold prayers.
So most of our lectures last year were online lectures. And people don't come to the mosque last year to observe Taraweeh. People don't come for the five daily prayers.
But things are different this year. Nigeria is seeing a lower number of cases, and mosques across the country are once again holding regular meetings and prayers. But the World Health Organization and Nigeria's CDC are also warning of a possible rise of COVID-19 cases during Ramadan. Mosque Secretary Abimbola Okwala says they're taking steps to prevent that.
As you are entering the mosque, there's provision for you to wash your hand. We have a tap, about four or five tap, at the gates. So as you are entering, the first place that you go to, there is an arrow, and there are some security personnel that will ensure that you wash your hand.
Okwala says everyone entering the mosque must also wear a face mask in line with WHO recommendations. Charity banquets and other communal gatherings remain banned in many countries around the world because of an upsurge in cases. But with safety measures in place, Ramadan this year is easier for Nigerian Muslims like Isa Idris. Timothy Obiezi for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
3 days of UN-mediated talks are underway to try to reunify the island of Cyprus, which has been divided between Greek and Turkish Cypriots since 1974. That was when Turkey invaded northern Cyprus in response to a Greek-backed military coup on the island. Mr. Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The Greek Cypriot and Turkish Cypriot leaders, as well as foreign ministers of three guarantor states, Greece, Turkey, and Britain, the former colonial ruler of Cyprus, will be holding so-called informal talks over the coming days. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres convened this meeting to test the waters, so to speak. His spokesman, Stephan Dujarric, says the aim of the meeting is to determine whether there is enough common ground for the parties to negotiate a lasting solution to the Cyprus issue within a foreseeable horizon.
The Secretary General will move forward based on the outcome of the informal talks. The parties are welcome to be creative, and the Secretary General will be encouraging them to move, to use diplomatic language in a sincere and frank manner.
The spokesman says Guterres will hold separate bilateral meetings Tuesday afternoon with the leaders of the two communities. In the evening, he will host a reception for the heads of delegations. On Wednesday morning, Guterres will host a plenary meeting with all five parties to be followed by bilateral meetings in the afternoon. There have been three attempts to reunify Cyprus since 2004. All have failed. The last attempt occurred in July 2017, 6 months after Guterres took office. Guterres took a hands-on approach to resolving this intractable issue, energized at the prospect of achieving a diplomatic win so soon after becoming the UN chief. 10 days of negotiations in the Swiss Alpine town of Crans-Montana also ended in failure. Dujarric says the Secretary General is unwilling to prejudge the outcome of the talks. He says this is an issue that Guterres knows well, as he has participated in discussions before. Dujarric says the Secretary General is neither cautiously optimistic nor pessimistic, but realistic. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
An international rights watchdog accused Israel on Tuesday of pursuing policies of apartheid and persecution against Palestinians and against its own Arab minority that amount to crimes against humanity. Emily Wither of Reuters reports.
Human Rights Watch has accused Israel of crimes against humanity by pursuing policies of apartheid and persecution against Palestinians and against its own Arab minority. The rights watchdog will be sharing the report with the International Criminal Court, who just weeks ago announced it would formally investigate war crimes in the Israeli-occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. The Israeli military and armed Palestinian groups such as Hamas were named as possible perpetrators. This was after ICC judges ruled that the court had jurisdiction there. Israel says it does not recognize the court's authority. Human Rights Watch is calling on the ICC prosecutor to investigate and prosecute individuals credibly implicated in apartheid and persecution. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas welcomed the report, while Israel's foreign ministry rejected the claims as both preposterous and false. The word apartheid is often associated with South Africa, but the rights watchdog said it wasn't aiming to make comparisons. Instead, it is assessing whether specific acts and policies constitute apartheid, as defined under international law. The group points to Israeli restrictions on Palestinian movement and seizure of Palestinian-owned land for Jewish settlement in territory occupied in the 1967 Middle East War as examples.
That's Emily Wither of Reuters. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.